obsessed with securing an empire for the United States. Tobacco culture represented an all-out assault on the environment for the sake of a crop that did no good and much harm to people's health as well as to the land, not to mention the political and moral effects of relying on slavery for a labor force. But to Virginia's planters, even to so inventive a man as Jefferson, there appeared to be no alternative. In fact, an alternative existed right under their noses. German immigrants, farming in the Shenandoah Valley, had a much different relationship with the land from that of the planters of English stock. The Germans had not received huge grants of land from the English king or the royal governor. They had bought their land in relatively small holdings. Coming from a country with a tradition of keeping the farm in the same family for generations, even centuries, they were in it for the long haul, not for quick profit. They cleared their fields of all trees and stumps, plowed deep to arrest erosion, housed their cattle in great barns, used manure as fertilizer, and practiced a precise scheme of crop rotation. They worked with their own hands, and their help came from their sons and relatives. No overseer, indentured servant, or slave, men with little interest in the precious undertaking of making a family farm, was allowed near their fields. Although Jefferson did not comment on the German farmers in Virginia, he did compare the planters' practices to those of European farmers and explained that the Europeans were much superior in agriculture for a simple reason. It results from our having such quantities of land to waste as we please. In Europe, the object is to make the most of their land, labor being abundant. Here it is to make the most of our labor, land being abundant. In the years following the Revolution, life on the Virginia plantation had much to recommend it. There was the reality of political independence. There were the balls and dinners, the entertainment. There was freedom of religion. The political talk about the nature of man and the role of government has not been surpassed at any time or any place since, and at its best, the talk could stand to be compared to the level in ancient Athens. Life at Monticello in the years after the Revolution was delightful to the eye, ear, taste, and intellect. Just imagine an evening as Thomas Jefferson's guest, following a day of riding magnificent horses over hedges, fields, and rivers, chasing fox or deer or bear. The entertainment would begin with toasts to the successful hunters. The table would be groaning under the weight of sweet potatoes, peas, corn, various breads, nuts, quail, ham, venison, bear, ducks, milk, and beer, all produced locally. The wines would come from France and be the best available in America, personally selected by Jefferson. If it was a large party, there would be conversations in French, Italian, and German, as well as English. Jefferson would play the violin for the Virginia Reel and other dances when he wasn't talking. Most guests found Jefferson to be the most delightful companion they ever met. He charmed and delighted his political enemies as well as his friends. "Spent the evening with Mr. Jefferson," John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary in Paris in 1785, "whom I love to be with." He later added, "You can never be an hour in this man's company without something of the marvelous." Before the election of 1800, Abigail Adams wrote of Jefferson, "He is one of the choice ones of the earth." Jefferson's guests were also choice. Whether from Europe or America, they were men of the Enlightenment, well-educated, intensely curious, avid readers, and pursuers of new knowledge of all kinds, but especially about natural history and geography. They were politically active, thoughtful about matters of government, full of insight into the human condition, and also witty conversationalists, quick with a quip, full of hearty laughter even when the joke was on them. Life on the Albemarle plantations after the Revolution had something of a Garden of Eden quality to it, but there was a snake in the garden. The glittering social, intellectual, economic, and political life of Virginia rested on the backs of slaves. Those backs were crisscrossed with scars because slavery relied on the lash. Not every master whipped his slaves. Jefferson almost surely never did. There is no evidence one way or another with Lewis. But every master had to allow his overseers to use the lash whenever the overseer saw fit or felt like it. Slavery worked through terror and violence. There was no other way to force men to work without compensation. This was the other side of the coin of one of the proudest boasts of the Virginia gentry. They claimed that they knew how to lead, that command came naturally to them. Edmund Burke spoke to this point. Although he disapproved of slavery, he observed that slave owners were among the foremost in asserting the rights of man precisely because they were slave owners. "Where there is a vast multitude of slaves, as in Virginia," he observed, "those who are free are by far the most proud and jealous of their freedom. To the masters of slaves, the haughtiness of domination combines with the spirit of freedom, fortifies it, and renders it invincible." Thus the sting in Dr. Samuel Johnson's embarrassing question, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" No man did more for human liberty than Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence and of Virginia's Statute for Religious Freedom, among other gifts to mankind. Few men profited more from human slavery than Jefferson. No man knew better than Jefferson the price Virginia paid for slavery, most of all in what the system did to young men. In Notes on the State of Virginia, he wrote, "The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part, and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it. If a parent could find no motive either in his philanthropy or his self-love for restraining the intemperance of passion towards his slave, it should always be a sufficient one that his children is present. But generally it is not sufficient. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to his worst of passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. The man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances." Jefferson knew whereof he wrote, and he knew no prodigies in this matter. Slavery was critical to tobacco planters because their agricultural practices were so wasteful and labor-intensive. Slavery prospered in the American South in the decades after the Revolution because of technological progress. By the time Jefferson became president, the steam engines of James Watt had been applied in England to spinning, weaving, and printing cotton, which led to an immense demand for that staple. Simultaneously, Eli Whitney's cotton gin had made it practical to separate short upland cotton from its seeds. Slaves and land were necessary to grow cotton. The land was available in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. The slaves were available from the excess on the Virginia plantations. These were the central economic facts in the life of the Virginia gentry, whose principal export soon became slaves. Profitable as it was to him, Jefferson hated slavery. He regarded it as a curse to Virginia and wished to see it abolished throughout the United States. Not, however, in his lifetime. He said that his generation was not ready for such a step. He would leave that reform to the next generation of Virginians and was sure they would make Virginia the first southern state to abolish slavery. He thought the young men coming of age in post-war Virginia were superbly qualified to bring the American Revolution to this triumphant conclusion because, as he said, these young men had sucked in the principles of liberty as if it were their mother's milk. Of all the contradictions in Jefferson's contradictory life, none exceeded this one. He hoped and expected that the Virginians from the generation of Lewis and Clark would abolish slavery, even while recognizing that anyone brought up as a master of slaves would have to be a prodigy to be undepraved by the experience. And it should be noted that, as far as can be told, he said not a word about his dream that young Virginians would lead the way to emancipation to precisely those young Virginians he knew best, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. Jefferson did not marry until 1 year short of his 30th birthday. Lewis never married. In this, they were unusual. As Jefferson noted, very few of the gentry pursued their studies to their 20th year, for they commonly married very young and were soon encumbered with families. They had to give constant attention to the management of their plantations. Attitudes toward and relations with women are central to every man's personality and character, but seldom discussed, especially among 18th century Virginia gentry. Jefferson, who wrote about almost everything, wrote little about women in general and almost nothing about his mother or his wife. Lewis never wrote about his mother. An exception in Jefferson's case was his remarks about the contrast between American and Parisian women. In America, Jefferson rejoiced, women knew their place, which was in the home and, more specifically, in the nursery. Instead of gadding frivolously about town as French women did, chasing fashion or meddling in politics, American women were content with the tender and tranquil amusements of domestic life and never troubled their pretty heads about politics. Foreign travelers tended to agree, at least to the extent that they found Virginia women dull and insipid. Denied any role in politics or the management of the plantation, surrounded by a small circle of household slaves, the women of the Virginia plantation tended to become indolent, self-indulgent, frustrated, and unhappy. The great ornithologist Alexander Wilson, in an 1809 letter describing a southern trip, commented, "Nothing has surprised me more than the cold, melancholy reserve of the females, of the best families. Old and young, single and married, all have that dull, frigid insipidity and reserve which is attributed to solitary old maids. Even in their own houses, they scarce utter anything to a stranger but yes or no." There were obvious exceptions, Jefferson's daughters, for example, and Lewis's mother. In general, however, it seems the men who ran Virginia plantations in the years after the Revolution missed an essential part of the human experience by denying themselves, or by having denied to them, a full, open, mutually respecting relationship with women. By contrast with the white women on the plantations, Wilson observed, "The Negro wenches are all sprightliness and gaiety." Winthrop Jordan, in his masterful study White Over Black, American Attitudes Toward the Negro, speculates that the dull frigidness of the white plantation women was hardened by the utter necessity of avoiding any resemblance to women of the other race. Jordan further points out that on the plantation, the traditional European double standard for the sexes was subject to caricatural polarization. More sexual freedom for white men meant less for white women. Whether Lewis indulged himself sexually with his female slaves or not is a subject on which no evidence of any kind exists. That many masters did so indulge themselves is a commonplace, with evidence aplenty in the form of mulattoes. Whether Jefferson so indulged himself is the subject of much speculation, argument, and controversy, all of it based on very little evidence. The most the scholar can say with confidence 2 centuries later is that the nature of Jefferson's and Lewis's relationships with women is almost unknown and unknowable. Jefferson wrote that, had Lewis stayed with it, his talent for observation, which had led him to an accurate knowledge of the plants and animals of his own country, would have distinguished him as a farmer. But although he was good at it, Lewis ran Locust Hill only out of necessity, not desire. What he wanted to do was roam and explore. On May 11, 1792, the American sea captain Robert Gray sailed into the estuary of a river he named for his ship Columbia and fixed its latitude and longitude. Jefferson, who had twice since the winning of independence tried to sponsor an American exploration across the continent, proposed to the American Philosophical Society of Philadelphia that a subscription be taken to engage a daring traveler to undertake an expedition to the Pacific. George Washington subscribed, as did Robert Morris and Alexander Hamilton. On hearing of the project, Lewis approached Jefferson and, in Jefferson's words, "warmly solicited me to obtain for him the execution of that object. I told him it was proposed that the person engaged should be attended by a single companion only, to avoid exciting alarm among the Indians." This did not deter him. Jefferson's high opinion of Lewis apparently did not extend that high. In any event, he passed over the teenage Lewis and chose instead a French botanist, André Michaud, who got started in June 1793. But he had scarcely reached Kentucky when Jefferson discovered that Michaud was a secret agent of the French Republic, whose chief aim was not to explore or collect natural history specimens, but to raise an army of American militia to attack the Spanish possessions beyond the Mississippi. At Jefferson's insistence, the French government recalled Michaud. Lewis, meanwhile, continued to toil on Locust Hill, but he was increasingly unhappy with the sedentary life of a planter. His mother was now well reestablished in the family home, and she was fully capable of running the plantation. His desire to see new lands, to explore, to experience, to roam, was insatiable. So, as Jefferson wrote, "At the age of 20, yielding to the ardor of youth and a passion for more dazzling pursuits, he engaged as a volunteer in the body of militia which were called out by General Washington to quell the Whiskey Rebellion." Chapter 3. Soldier, 1794 to 1800. The Whiskey Rebellion of 1794 was the greatest threat to national unity between the winning of independence and the outbreak of the Civil War. The North-South split over slavery had nothing to do with it. The struggle pitted West against East. The precipitate cause was simple enough: a new tax. Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton wanted to increase the power and extend the reach of the federal government. In addition, the government needed money. Hamilton therefore laid an excise tax on whiskey, the principal product of the Trans-Appalachian region. Those at the frontier felt neglected, misunderstood, mistreated. There was little or no hard cash around, yet Hamilton demanded a tax paid in currency. A tax on whiskey was a tax on what the frontier made and sold, not on what it purchased. Exactly the objection the Founding Fathers had raised against internal taxes imposed by England before the Revolution. More generally, the frontiersmen complained that the government attempting to collect the tax neglected to provide Western settlers with protection from the Indians, failed to build Western roads or canals, and favored the rich absentee land speculators, the biggest and most important of whom was President Washington himself, over the simple, hard-working frontiersman who was trying to acquire land and build a home. The frontier farmers revolted. They refused to pay the tax, they shot at revenue officers, they tarred and feathered revenue officers, they burned down the houses of revenue officers. President Washington, alarmed at these symptoms of riot and violence, called out 13,000 militiamen from Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland in August 1794 to quell the rebellion. Washington needed volunteers because the regular army, with an authorized strength of 5,424 officers and men, was in the Ohio country on an Indian campaign led by Major General Anthony Wayne, launched in response to two successive, humiliating, and costly defeats suffered by the army in Ohio. In 1790, under General Josiah Harmar, and in 1791, under General Arthur St. Clair. Those Indian victories had inspired widespread Indian attacks on frontier settlements, which in turn were among the causes of the Whiskey Rebellion. On the East Coast, men might fear a standing army. In the West, they clamored for one that could protect them. On August 20th, 1794, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, at the rapids of the Maumee River in northwestern Ohio, Wayne won a decisive victory, thus meeting one of the chief complaints of the Western rebels, which was that the army would not or could not provide protection. Word of that victory had not reached Pennsylvania, however, when Washington called out the militia. Nor did Westerners know that Chief Justice John Jay was negotiating for a British withdrawal from the posts in the Northwest. Another source of unhappiness, for the frontiersmen believed the British encouraged Indian massacres of American pioneers. Jay's treaty would be signed in London in November 1794, but news did not reach the United States until March 1795. There was a certain irony in the Whiskey Rebellion. Washington, Hamilton, and the other heroes of the American Revolution who were determined to put down this rebellion were espousing a policy that they had once risked their lives to oppose: taxation without representation. for there was no question about the truth of the complaints from the frontier that this excise tax on whiskey was specific to the Westerners and that they were not properly represented in the general government that imposed the tax. Implicit in the rebellion was the idea of secession, a second American Revolution. The rhetoric of the whiskey rebels was all but identical to the rhetoric of Sam and John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Patrick Henry. The logic of the rebellion was the logic of the revolution. Just as the ocean that separated England from America dictated that they should be two nations, so did the mountains separate the East from the West and dictate two nations. But what the West saw as simple political logic, the East saw as riot and rebellion. President Washington had not suffered the rigors of Valley Forge or come out of retirement to serve as the first president in order to preside over the dissolution of the nation or lose ownership of the tens of thousands of acres he owned in the West. Rumors of negotiations between rebels and representatives of England and Spain inspired Washington and Eastern nationalists with military fervor. So determined was the president to put down the rebels that he took the field to review the troops who answered his call. Among those troops was Meriwether Lewis. He was one of the first to enlist as a private in the Virginia Volunteer Corps. Surely a part of his motivation was his lust for adventure and his penchant for roving, but he told himself and his mother that he signed on for the campaign in order to support the glorious cause of liberty and my country. He considered the rebels to be traitors and was delighted that our leading men are determined entirely to consume every atom of that turbulent and refractory spirit that exists among the insurgents. He was hardly alone. Thousands of young men from the Middle States volunteered. They had been children during the Revolutionary War. Throughout their teenage years, they had heard war stories from their fathers and uncles.